runasradio.com. You're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Nguyen announcing show number 283 with guest Joe Sack, recorded Sunday, September 9th, 2012. Run As Radio is produced each week by PWOP Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thank you so much for listening to Run As Radio. Although at this particular moment, through the magic of time shifting, I am in an RV traveling across the United States with two stops in Canada on the great big .NET Rocks Visual Studio 2012 road trip. Now, most of you that listen to this show probably know we do a few other shows, including .NET Rocks and the Tablet Show. Run As Radio is also along for the tour. We're going to continue publishing shows. We're going to do some live and some not. But we hope you'll come out to our road trip. So that's 35 cities, including two in Canada. And you can see the whole list and exactly what's going on where at .NETRocks.com/roadtrip. So I hope you'll join us, come and see us in person, and watch the craziness that is podcasting on the road. But for today's show, we're going to talk a little SQL Server performance, and our guest today is Joe Sack. He's a principal consultant, author, and trainer at SQLSkills.com. Prior to joining SQL Skills, Joe worked at Microsoft as a premier field engineer for large enterprise environments. He is a SQL Server Microsoft Certified Master for versions 2005 and 2008. He was also the program manager for the SQL Server MCM program from 2009 to 2011. He's written multiple books, articles, and white papers, including SQL Server 2008 Transact SQL Recipes from APress, and most recently, two new Microsoft SQL Server 2012 Always-On Architecture Guides. And his first instructional video course, SQL Server Transact SQL Basic Data Retrieval, was recently published at Pluralsight. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And existing and previously PFEs are always welcome here because you guys work on the real problems.
Yeah, it was a great job. And I kind of feel like I get to be a PFE outside of Microsoft too at SQL Skills. So the fun continues.
I mean, yeah, the consulting that I know from working with Paul and Kim over the years, that their field work, when they're not just teaching, when they're actually consulting, you never get called into the easy problems. You only get called in for the hard problems.
That's right. Yeah, definitely. I find that we get the tough problems, and that was the same as a PFE as well.
Sure.
Very, very few softball questions.
Well, and my only problem with there's two issues I had with the PFEs. One is I felt like you had to be a pretty big customer to even have the PFE option available to you.
Yeah, that's fair. I actually worked with a couple of very large retail customers in Minneapolis, and typically, it was with very large customers, very large environments.
Sure.
We're talking like 1,000 SQL Server instances, 400 different failover clusters. So I'd say that's a fair statement.
And the other one was I really struggled with, you guys had such insight into how the product was being used, and I never was sure that the product team heard you or that you got enough time to communicate back to the product team, this is how the customer is using your product.
Yeah, I think that's fair as well. Sometimes that communication got through. Example being when I had one customer that really wanted to take advantage of the secondary mirror. So they were using database mirroring in their environment, and they asked me questions about, you know, how can we do more persistent reporting against the mirrors? How can we do backups against the mirrors?
Mm-hmm.
And so I gave feedback actually using connect.microsoft.com, and I heard back from a program manager on the SQL CAT team. And a lot of that feedback funneled through to the always-on availability group feature.
Nice.
And so that was a good example. But, yeah, there's plenty of other examples where you'll get the not going to fix response or no response at all.
Right. Those guys are inundated, too. It feels to me like the PFEs own a substantial chunk of knowledge. There needs to be, I don't know, a day a week where you could just work with the product teams to really push back the experience you're having out in the field.
I agree 100%. And when I was in PFE, I always wanted my fellow PFEs to speak up as much as possible. And that includes blogging and speaking at different events because they have a ton of very valuable knowledge. And I found with the PFE organization, they were not very ego-driven.
Right.
A lot of very bright people that were easy to work with. and didn't personalize things, and yet extremely bright and able to solve tough problems.
Although, you know, I find anybody who's actually out there fighting the battle day in, day out, a lot of the rhetoric around those guys were incompetent, you're just doing it wrong, all of that stupidity gets stripped away. I've seen too many good solutions, too many bad solutions to point at any one thing and say, this is why you succeed, this is why you fail. There's no one right way, and there's no guarantee of success.
I absolutely agree. And I think that when you see just the level of complexity and the number of variables you have to pay attention to, it's humbling. And also when you see the best of the brightest struggle on issues that you've never seen, maybe you only see it once in your lifetime, you become a lot less arrogant.
Sure.
That gets beaten out of you.
Turns out there's a lot more edges than you knew.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And that's one thing, that's actually a factor that I pay attention to with some client engagements. If somebody's telling me, hey, you know, our staff is the best of the brightest and we have this design down, and don't worry about indexing, we've already got indexing taken care of, and don't worry about, you know, the SQL Server settings and best practices, we've already got that covered. We want you just to pay attention to this one little corner.
Yeah.
That's when I start asking the questions.
Ah, yeah, the great performance tuning debate. We don't have time to actually measure anything. Just make this go faster.
Exactly. Exactly.
When you were working as a PFE, and I guess as you work now with SQL Skills as well, this is still the job, right? It's like, we need this to go faster.
Yeah, it's absolutely still the job. I have a lot of different roles at SQL Skills, though. So a key thing I was looking forward to was just the variety.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, getting to write and getting to blog and to teach and to, you know, we were doing the video recordings and then getting a chance to do some hardcore consulting. I wanted to have everything and be able to do all of those things in one role. And so I have the opportunity to do that with SQL Skills. And I also get to hang out with Paul and Kimberly, which is probably the most fun I've ever had in the job.
It's always an adventure with those two. Yeah. There are two ways about that. You never know what's going to happen. I think they're about due to come hang out on this show pretty soon as well.
Good.
Talk to me about your approach to performance tuning. When confronted with that issue, if I'm okay, you know, clearly I've gotten to a point where my app is busy enough that people care about performance. They're seeing issues they believe are the database. What do you start with?
Oh, I definitely start with looking at weight statistics. I'm really hardcore about that, and I've been so for a few years. And for those of your listeners that aren't familiar with weight statistics, essentially SQL Server and the SQL Server engine was written to mark off when it had to wait for some kind of resource, whether it was waiting for an IO or memory or a latch or a lock. And there's hundreds of these different points. Some of them are just background processes. They're normal. You would expect them to accumulate on a quiet system.
Mm-hmm.
But some are much more telling of specific reasons why your query load is taking as long as it is. And so I always start off with that. And there's multiple scopes that you can start with. I mean, you can look at the SQL Server instance level and say, all right, show me all accumulated waits over the last day. But you could also look at the request level. So if I get a call that says, hey, we're having an issue right now, I can jump on. And the first thing I'd look at is there's a dynamic management view called sys.dmos waiting tasks. And I'm looking out there first because a lot of times it'll tell me across multiple different issues what is wrong. So whether it's a blocking issue, a memory issue, there were a few months ago I had something where I called it the observer overhead issue, where the only issue that they had was they had too much tracing going on. So they just saw the degradation of performance, and I looked and I saw all these different trace write wait types, and they said, look, everything's slow. And I said, well, hey, can you turn off some of these traces? And they said, yeah, but that's not going to help. And I said, well, just indulge me and turn them off. And sure enough, they turned off the 9 or 10 different traces they had running.
Wow.
And performance returned.
Somebody had gotten a little happy with SQL Profiler.
Oh, it's common. It's common. And I understand why it happens, especially if you have an environment with a lot of developers.
Sure.
And you give them access to turn on traces and watch things, and then they might go to lunch and come back later. And then meanwhile, you have this overhead that's difficult to track down.
Well, yeah, like you said, it's classic observer effect. You're looking for slowdowns. I battled one of these where as long as the trace was on, we never deadlocked. So you sort of trace off, we get the deadlock again. And it's like, okay, the observer effect has altered the behavior enough that the deadlock goes away. Make you crazy. But, you know, these are the things. They don't think that that tracing's free.
Yes, absolutely. And it also really relies on which events you're watching, too. Because when you think back in, I think it was 2006, 2007, we were looking at a trade application and somebody turned on Profiler with query execution plan enabled.
Man.
And CPU just drove up through the roof. So that's just one example out of many. But to your original question about what my methodology is, I'm looking at weight stats first and foremost.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I start there. I don't end there. And
no.
I think that's the big factor is that just helps me minimize the amount of time it takes to get to the real root cause, because most busy production systems have multiple things that might be wrong with it. But you're being asked to, you know, when you're coming into a consulting engagement like this, you're being asked to troubleshoot the issue at hand.
Right.
And that's very helpful.
And it sort of turns on the head, you know, you're not strapping a harness onto this machine to measure its performance. It already knows what it's waiting for.
Exactly. It's very lightweight. And you can do it down even to the request level. So just a few weeks ago, I had an engagement where they had this query in a user acceptance testing environment. And he could not predict when it ran slowly. But when it ran slowly, it ran slowly for several minutes.
Okay.
And he said, look, I don't know what's going on. And so what we were able to do is set up a job that just ran that query every few seconds. And I was able to grab that session ID and use extended events to capture the accumulated wait stats for that session. So when the issue happened, you know, we were capturing begin and end time of the queries. We were able to go, okay, look, this is, you know, at 2 p.m. in the afternoon, something happened. We were then able to say, okay, the wait type associated with this, in this case, was page IO latch related. And then we started looking at, all right, what was happening concurrently that was driving so much IO? Was there another query out there that didn't have proper indexing? And it just leads you into a better direction instead of saying, well, let's run SDWHO in a loop or, you know what, I saw locking last week. Let's start with locking. It puts some rigor around the process.
Right. And you really don't want to start. Yeah. Just poking around at random scares me. Going after something you can reproduce and have a chance of running again and actually know you made better.
Absolutely.
So what about query profiles or query plans?
I'm very big on looking at query plans. I think as SQL Server users, we've been a little bit spoiled because mm-hmm. a lot of times you can just write your query, you know, it's declarative mostly. And so you write the query and then SQL Server picks out the best plan. But when you have a performance issue, understanding how to read a query execution plan is absolutely critical. And I'm definitely a big proponent of not just DBAs knowing how to read an execution plan, but
yep.
developers as well. It's always a good opportunity to get a chance to go through different operations and explain, okay, why is this meaningful and why should you care? Including issues around cardinality estimate issues. So knowing that the rows being estimated for the different operators in the plan,
mm-hmm.
if they're highly skewed, what impact would that have on your plan? If you're dealing with incorrect information, it can have a significant impact, especially for those larger plans, including like memory grant issues or overestimating it. You might be reducing concurrency. So I'm definitely big on evaluating that. Typically, it's downstream, so if people don't know, okay, I don't know what the performance issue is in the first place.
Right.
It might take a few steps to get to those specific queries that we're looking at, but once we get there, it's important to know, all right, here are the things in the plan that I would pay attention to.
And I think this is something that folks generally struggle with, is understanding that SQL Server can lose track of certain statistics about its database. It doesn't know how many rows there are, how unique those rows are, that sort of problem.
Right. Yeah. It definitely, there's a lot of factors, you know, I in the ideal state, you have statistics associated with the objects that you're accessing.
Mm-hmm.
And ideally those statistics are accurate. But if you have huge data skews or you have atypical values, you know, or you have a very large table where even with the 200 steps, it's really not good enough to get accurate statistics.
Mm-hmm.
That can cause problems. There's heuristics too. So SQL Server has to take a guess. Sometimes those guesses can be way off just based on what predicates you're using in your query. And I always say when it comes to cardinality estimate issues, if you only have to update your statistics to solve the problem, that's a good day.
Yeah, no kidding.
That's the easiest one. So,
but it doesn't always work out that way.
No. And I very rarely get the just update your stats and you're done. That's not to say that it doesn't happen. And, you know, with our health check, we'll do health checks where we'll look at SQL Server instance level settings and database level settings. We always check for the upstream obvious answers. You know, for example, if they have automatic update and creative statistics disabled. But rarely is that the actual root cause. Usually when, by the time it gets to us, we're dealing with other more complicated issues.
Yeah, it does sound like, I mean, this is something that you update the statistics just like you make sure the thing's still plugged in before you go calling Joe.
Yeah, but typically then what I would see for, let's say we have a kind of a hybrid environment where it's not necessarily OLTP and it's not necessarily pure data warehousing. What I'll see is very complex queries. Let's say you have a join against 20 different tables.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you're referencing views that reference views that reference views. And then throw in there a few user-defined functions that, you know, hide proper cardinality estimates. And you've got a lot of stuff that you have to unwind to just get a high-quality plan in the first place.
Sure. I would hate to read that plan.
Right. Yeah, I use the SQL Sentry Plan Explorer quite a bit,
mm-hmm.
Especially for cardinality estimate issues, because there's a tab where you can compare the actual versus estimated numbers quite easily.
Right.
But that's, again, the easy part. So identifying the issue, yep, you've got a cardinality estimate issue, but when it comes down to the solution, there's a lot of different things that you can do, but they vary in complexity, all including rewriting your query, breaking it apart into smaller queries, taking your predicates, so if you have a where clause, that you're burying every single expression as much as possible, and the optimizer doesn't even know
yeah.
what the statistics are, that can take quite a bit of time to fix.
Yeah, you're right. It's one thing to, you've managed to fool SQL Server and not knowing what to do with this data, and it's just going to table walk everything. But how do you untangle that now?
Yeah, and sometimes it's a non-trivial task. And then that's really where it comes down to how important is this specific workload.
Sure.
How much have you encapsulated it? So if it's just pure ad hoc, it's a lot more difficult than if you say, look, we need to refactor the stored procedure. That's great. Now, the interfaces have been pretty cleaned up, and all I need to do is maybe change a few intermediate steps.
Mm-hmm.
But it can be a bit tough when things are baked in at outside of the stored procedure, for example.
Do you find yourself battling deadlocks anymore, or is that sort of gone by the wayside?
Oh yeah, I definitely battle deadlocks with a couple of my clients,
mm-hmm.
At least once or twice a month. It's very common, and it's more common, I would say, for older code.
Right.
I see with newer code coming out that people have gotten the message about, you know, retrying or changing the order of operations or making sure that the index is appropriately created. But I still do see deadlocking, and I still see a lot of concurrency issues. Just general issues around, okay, I need as much throughput as possible, and we're getting lock escalation.
Right.
Or I have a few key queries that I mentioned earlier, the memory grants. They might have cardinality estimate issues where their memory grants are much larger than they actually need to be
mm-hmm.
because of that cardinality estimate issue. And then your concurrency reduces, and then that's the problem you have to really troubleshoot. But deadlocks, yes. Blocking, I would say even more so. Just in longer-term blocking and then
sure.
trying to help with solutions for that.
Well, and this comes from people writing a lot of stuff. The giant stored procedure seems to be the deadlock generator.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And then multiple giant stored procedures
yeah.
Going through at the same time.
Yeah, these five stored procedures all ran on three different connections more or less at the same time. And gee, I'm surprised it worked at all.
Right. Yeah, and sometimes with those kind of stored procedures, I end up asking, you talked about the is it plugged in question.
Yeah.
I'll look at what they're doing, and it might be a table that they're updating with stored procedure, which has recursive triggers firing against it. And it might be, let's say, to update a licensing key. And I'll go, okay, did you know that these triggers are here and are they still needed? And I see they were created, you know, 9 years ago.
Right.
What was the original intent? And sometimes just asking a few simple questions can eliminate a lot of work. To refactor, because they might go, oh, we don't even use that table, or, oh, I don't even know why there's triggers because we're updating it in the store procedure itself. So it's important to be able to not get wrapped around the axle in these kind of engagements, however tempting it might be.
Sure. I think you always need to take a step further back than you thought.
Right.
Just try to get yeah. a picture of that. I mean, those triggers are going to surface in a query plan.
Yes.
So you
yeah,
are gonna,
yeah.
I mean, it comes with, you know, one of the reasons I've always felt like triggers were evil once we got, you know, past sequel 4.3 was that they were hidden. They didn't know when they executed, what order they executed in. You know, they were hard to realize they were even going on.
Yeah. And when I find that, in terms of religious debates, you know, the triggers and primary key choice, surrogate mm-hmm. versus natural, I never try to fight, for example, the trigger battle, but I do remind people that they will forget about the triggers,
yes.
even if they're looking at the plan or looking at the associated IO with it and going, well, why is it doing these extra IOs? I don't know why that's happening. So having an awareness of triggers in and of itself is, I think, a challenge. So if there's another way for people to do it in a more tightly coupled way, then I recommend that.
Yeah. Keeping those things together. But this also comes down to the age, the generation of the person that wrote this code. You run into this where I know I have old school hangups around SQL tuning.
That's absolutely. And I would say the biggest, I look for what I call like cave canaries.
Mm-hmm.
So I look for little signs where, I see this hint, for example, I see somebody put in a specific join operation hint in the code.
Right.
That will immediately alert me to start asking other questions and start checking other areas.
Sure.
And that includes server settings, database settings. But if I see anything that kind of shows a little bit of fiddling, or maybe there was a really good reason why they chose to, you know, use a hash join algorithm versus merge or loop. But when I see it, I go, okay, do you know the history behind it? Oftentimes they don't.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes they go, well, somebody put it in, and let's try taking it out, and sure enough, that solves the issue.
Right. So I'll throw my developer's hat on here for a moment, but I because we deal with cruft on the code side too. It's not an unusual thing. Why is that there? Is it even used anymore? That sort of stuff. But I don't think we think in terms enough of those mindsets around SQL Server, that we build up this debris of technique and technology over time.
Yeah, and your own bias and your own experience of what's worked and what hasn't worked. And it's another area of consulting, and also going back to PFE, where you just really kind of have to just listen and ask for the data.
Yeah.
And let people vent. And that includes the SQL skills consulting that I've been doing. You let people go through the backstory. And then after you're done with it, you go, hey, could you show me the data?
Right.
Because in the end, I'm not terribly concerned that you cross your T's and dot your I's. If your goal is performance, sometimes it just takes a few tweaks. And if I'm not asking all the basic questions and then asking for you to show me that evidence, then I'm not doing my job.
Right. I actually have to look at all that data. Are you running into projects these days where the developers are introducing more issues, that the folks that are working in the pure object-first entity framework approaches, so that the DBA hasn't got as much control over its database, that, you know, things are being generated differently, queries are much more direct, stored procedures are becoming rare, and it feels to me like we're pushing the problem back onto the developer, and they're creating a whole new set of, in some ways, old issues.
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely seen that emerge, but I also don't always assume that it's going to be an issue, because
right.
there's certain virtues to it as well, and my whole thing is that once people get used to it, it's kind of like the virtualization discussion.
Mm-hmm.
A few years ago, I was pretty much against virtualization. I didn't like the idea of it. And we're talking maybe six, seven years ago, where I said, oh, God, this is not a good idea.
Sure.
And now I don't bat an eye at it, because there's so many useful use cases. And I think the same thing with ORM, you know, and just giving the developer more leeway in specific kinds of architectures. I don't think people are going to bat an eye on this over time. It just needs to evolve.
Yeah, we kind of get used to it.
Yeah, just like, the example of data type, you know, I remember seeing kind of a big blog discussion about data type conversions, of doing implicit data type conversions. And I think ultimately that discussion on the web provided a solution. So you had both sides communicating with each other. But I've definitely seen movement towards that type of coding, and it introduces other challenges. But I would say even more than it was before. I mean, I see all developer shops that you have a great schema, and I see where it's skewed towards the DBA side, and the schema needs a lot of untangling. So
right.
I don't assume either which way. I've seen a variety.
Yeah, but like I said, no one right way.
Yeah, Yeah, which is tough too, because people want the golden answer.
Yeah.
And sometimes you, again, it's just getting the facts and then what your timeline and budget is.
Sure.
That helps decide, okay, what kind of blue sky are you aiming toward, or do we really just have enough time to adjust a few things and do the best that we can?
Yeah. And we tend to go to one of the other extremes, right? Either just fiddle a little bit and it'll work, or throw this all away. Let's start over.
Right. Right.
And the truth's always somewhere in between those two.
Absolutely.
It's a bit more work than you thought, but not as worth tossing out the baby with the bathwater either.
Right. Yeah. And it definitely, the doing from scratch is nice. But like you said, then you introduce your own host of issues potentially with the new architecture.
Sure. Have you taken much of a look at SQL 2012? Is this going to impact the way we do performance tuning or, you know, behavior of certain features?
Yeah, I've definitely taken a look at SQL Server 2012. I'd say the two areas I've been paying the most attention to would be column store indexing, and then on the HADR side, availability groups.
Mm-hmm.
From a performance tuning perspective, I am pretty excited about column store indexing and the idea of speeding up queries to that magnitude for relational data warehouses. It's very appealing, and I'm curious to see where it goes. You might be familiar already with the fact that once you create the column store index, that table becomes read-only with the exception of partitioning. So you can use partition switch in and out of mm-hmm. that table. You can't do regular insert, update, delete, or merge operations.
Huh.
Yeah. So I tell people that, and they go, well, I'm going to rule that out. But you think about the nature of a lot of relational data warehouses where maybe you're just doing incremental loads every couple of hours or once a day.
Right.
And maybe you're already partitioning it. I don't see that it's that far off the mark for being usable in the RPM version. And again, the benefits might be significant. I'd say that's going to be a game changer, not just for the columns for indexing, which basically instead of having the row-based storage, you're having the column-based storage model in a blob form. Instead of having just that column store indexing be part of the discussion, there's also the new batch mode execution. So your standard OLTP-centric query, your standard queries for 2012 are row mode, you know, where you have one row at a time going up and down the pipeline, or I should say you have control flowing from the left to the right, and then your actual data moving from the right to the left.
Right.
In envisioning the query execution plan. Now, with column store indexing, in conjunction with batch mode, you're having these blocks of 1,000 rows at a time push up from the leaf level of the execution plan, so to speak. And they're taking advantage of modern processors, really avoiding a lot of cache misses, you know, taking advantage of that L1 cache.
Right.
And it's extreme performance potential. And I'm going to be interested to see in future versions of SQL Server where they go with this. So where they could potentially apply batch mode to other areas, not just in conjunction with columns for indexing.
Sure. Yeah, it's a whole other class of velocity, and it's something we usually had to end up going to NoSQL for.
Yes, it's a tremendous improvement in performance to the point where sometimes people don't even believe it. So, and the nice thing about, you know, I loved my time at Microsoft, but now that I'm at SQL Skills, I don't necessarily have to toe the party line. But even now, I'm kind of a little bit gushy about column store indexing. I'm pretty excited about where it could potentially go. And again, there's a lot of caveats, as there is with any kind of V1 of a technology, but it's pretty pretty promising.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does sort of point a direction to some future versions as well. They are moving the product well, just when you thought SQL Server was done.
Right.
It's always something new. But it does, you know, lend to some interesting instrumentation issues. How are we going to measure this new tool? Like, do we know how we're when it's performing well and when it's not?
Yes, yeah. Is that something that needs to evolve as well? Because I think there's a lot of things that we're used to looking at
mm-hmm.
that might be less helpful, you know, when we're talking about column store indexing, for example. Even I will say this for those folks that are going with column store indexing today, the big thing to look at in your query execution plan is whether you're running in batch mode versus row mode.
Right.
If you're not running in batch mode, you're not leveraging the full potential of column store indexing. And that's very easy to find out whether you're running in that mode. It's just a matter of hovering over those operations that you would expect to be running in batch mode. If you don't see it, then it's something that you need to troubleshoot.
And this has to do with the way it's locked when it's being added to?
Well, so the basic thing is, if you think about the standard data warehouse query,
mm-hmm.
you might have a fact table with 80 different columns in it.
Sure.
And maybe you're referencing just four or five of them. So you're saying, okay, aggregate orders and sales by a store. And so the key thing is, first of all, you're pulling this compressed version of just those columns that you need. You're not pulling all the other columns with it.
Right.
So that's the column-based storage. And then of that column-based storage, there's a compression being added. And how compressible that data is depends on your fact table. But if you think about the standard fact table, you have quite a bit of compression potential typically. You know, especially if you're talking about just a certain set of dimension keys and different values, you know, let's say store quantities. Now, the batch mode on top of that can say, look, instead of pushing one row at a time from the leaf level of the plan, I want to push 1,000 rows at a time. And then when it's pushed through at the engine level, it's actually able, when it's able to run in batch mode, it's able to work with 1,000 rows, you know, that vector at the same exact time. And it's not having any misses and it's not doing one row at a time. And again, really leveraging modern processor architecture. On top of that, there's something called segment elimination.
Right.
So you have the column store indexes. The internal storage is stored in million row segments, you know, for the specific column. And if you, depending on how you've done your clustered index, you could have situations where if I have a predicate that's based on a date, and that happens to also be how I've put together my key, you can have entire million columns and million row blocks bypassed as part of the plan.
Wow.
And again, this is, we're talking in the batch operations. If you're not running in batch mode, then you're going to have problems. And there's specific query constructs that have more problems with running in batch mode. For example, union all or outer type queries. And if you look at Eric Hansen, if you do a search on Eric Hansen and column store indexing FAQ,
mm-hmm.
he goes through a few different scenarios where if you're running in row mode, how do you get out of row mode to batch mode? But this is stuff that, you know, again, it's V1. I would imagine in service packs or next versions, you're going to see a lot of these concerns eliminated as well.
Yeah, it is early days for these features.
Absolutely. Yeah, and it looks like there's a lot of momentum around it. People are excited about it, so I don't think it'll die on the vine by any means. And so it'll be interesting to see if there'll be a convergence. So maybe people who are using analysis services today
right.
might start migrating a little bit over to the relational data warehouse side of things.
Yeah, which is an interesting twist on the whole thing. You know, we're getting more and more ways to solve these problems.
Yes, yes.
Back to the whole concept of there's no one right way. In fact, there's more ways than ever before.
Right, and it's a matter of narrowing it down to a few choices, making sure that it meets your business requirements, and then testing.
Absolutely. Joe, thanks so much for coming to talk to us.
Yeah, thanks for your time, Ed. I appreciate you having me.
And where can we see you next?
Well, next, I'm actually going to be in Redmond doing a private training course. I'm based in Minneapolis.
Oh, yes.
But after that, pretty soon, Paul and Kimberly are going to be posting our 2013 schedule. And that'll have the different locations of where we're teaching at the immersion events.
Nice.
So I teach in the performance tuning immersion event, and then also the high availability and disaster recovery events.
So we can find that at sequelskills.com.
Yeah, sequelskills.com. And then we'll be streaming out different Pluralsight videos too. I think there'll actually be 6 new courses just in the next month. And then we'll continue putting a lot of content out there over the next couple of years.
Awesome. Joe Sack, so thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.